AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's RUBRIK.com.
Menards Black Friday sale is here. Get everything you need to bring home the holidays. A Nerf Blaster dog toy blasts tennis balls 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing squish lamps and Performax drill bit sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Hurry in while supplies last. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
We know that in chess, control the four center squares of the board, you can kind of dictate the pace of the match. The same's true in boxing. It's called ring generalship.
First, I was a little scared when he came in, like, and he started swinging, and I'm like, oh, this man trying to kill me.
I can't imagine in chess boxing, the nervousness is probably intensified greatly because it's also like, okay, now I'm about to get hit, right? It's,
you know, sorry, Andrea, but Dina won that fight. The announcement is really for you, Christian.
Okay.
Which is...
Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of the C-Squared podcast. Today, we have a special episode. We have two guests. I don't think we've ever had that, at least not in this online setup. But today, we have James Canty III, who just became a chess boxing world champion, as well as Matt Thomas, who is the founder of chess boxing and the promoter, the main promoter of chess boxing in the United States, a world champion of his own as well. Welcome, boys.
Was good. Good to be here. I'm back. I did a C-Square pod before. Actually, if you go see, I was a bigger boy. Like, I had a little bit more meat on my face and, like, you know, I was heavier, right? So I wasn't boxing much then either, but it was, so I'm glad to be here. What's up, Matt?
Yo, I'm happy to be here too. This is a debut for me. I'm excited to talk to you guys about chess boxing and anything else.
Matt, I need to start with you because you were kind of the moving force behind chess boxing, at least in the United States. I mean, I know that it's happening in Russia a lot, but in the U.S., nobody actually knew what chess boxing is, and nobody, to be honest, cared about chess boxing. But since you sort of started moving things around, and now you're putting a team together, and we'll get into that in just a second, but how did it all start for you?
Yeah, so the sport was created when I was 13. It was, it way predates me. It was started in Berlin by our founder, Ipe Rubing. And around that time, I grew up playing chess. I grew up in Charlotte, so they had a great chess scene. And I grew up doing martial arts. So, I tell people martial arts kind of shaped my body and the way I move, and chess shaped the way I think. And so... You know, fast forward like 10, 12 years, I was sitting in a recovery bed after a surgery, watching YouTube, watching, old fights and playing online chess, chess.com, and YouTube's algorithm completely nailed me. It auto-played a chess boxing video, and I thought it was a complete joke like everyone else does when they see it. I thought it was absurd. But I did a little digging and found out it was legit, and Ipe was on a quest to find the smartest, toughest person on the planet, and I wanted to get involved, and so I reached out to him. He plugged me into the international scene, and 2 years later, flew over to Calcutta, India to start competing.
I saw you have a few wins on your record. One of them obviously gave you that world championship title. But were you a boxer? You said you were a martial artist, but were you a boxer specifically, or were you doing other martial arts before starting chess boxing?
Yeah, so my first martial art, I started when I was six, which was Taekwondo. My mom was a single mom, so I was always in after-school program, and it was 2 days a week was chess club and 3 days a week was martial arts. So competed in Taekwondo through like teenage years. And then because Taekwondo is mostly a kicking art, I felt really underdeveloped with my hands. And when I got to college, they had a boxing team at University of Georgia. So I tried out for the boxing team and I was pretty like new, but I had potential, and the coach kind of took me under his wing, and I started learning hands and competed for University of Georgia for 3 years. And then had an amateur career through my early 20s, had a few pro bouts that were mostly like show matches, like celebrity boxing kind of thing. And that's how I got injured, which is the injury that led me to finding chess boxing. So, I never intended to like go pro and make boxing my life. I did it as a hobby, and you know, the joke's on me. It, you know, this hobby has kind of taken over my life now.
James, I want to kind of, ask you the same question. How did you hear about chess boxing, and when did you get involved with it?
Yeah, I got involved with Matt, actually. Matt, this had to be, I've been boxing like 3 years now, actually. So 2022, I got with Matt, and I remember he just, it was a Dallas, what was it, DreamHack we was at?
DreamHack,
where they needed someone to come out there, basically, and like, you know, support the chess part. And like, I think it was chess.com helped a little bit with that. And we just went out there and was debuting chess boxing. So Matt was doing like a creator thing where creators was doing kind of a chess boxing fit. They like play some chess, hit some pads, hit some mitt work and stuff like that. And I was like, cool, this is, you know, this is fun. Like, I'm not into boxing, really, like, seriously. I like watching, but I wasn't seriously, like, with the hands yet. And so Matt was like, yo, bro, you could probably be, like, a world champ at this, you know, with your chest strength. And, like, you know, if you just start boxing a little bit, I'm like, you know what, I'll give it a shot. So when I got back home, I started boxing, actually. And when I got back home, it was kind of incredible because I didn't know how the conditioning of boxing was. I was lifting, always lifting heavy, always in the gym, doing some cardio, but boxing killed me. Like, it was different. It was a different type of cardio. And I was like, oh, this is different. I need to learn how to do this, right? So I was really hyped about boxing, and I took it very serious, you know. So now we're here.
Oh, I didn't see you there. You might be wondering, what am I doing here? Well, I'm getting my reps in. You know, one of the most common questions I get is, how do you actually learn a new opening? Honestly, the best way, hands down, is by using chessreps.com. They've got these super fun, interactive opening courses that actually work. This isn't one of those chess courses you watch once and forget. These are fully interactive courses. You're not passively listening. You're actively playing the moves, getting quizzed on variations, and building that crucial muscle memory. It feels more like a game than studying. Hundreds of thousands of players have already used chessreps.com to break through plateaus and hit their highest ever ELO. And here's the cool part. They actually want you to see how powerful this is for yourself. Right now, you can take their entire Vienna Gambit and Stafford Gambit courses completely free. You don't even have to sign up. Just head over to chessreps.com and start learning. Right now, they have 25 courses for you, and they release a new one every single week. Seriously, this is the best way to learn openings. Go try it out at chessreps.com.
Fabi.
Interested in chess box? What's your take?
I am interested, and actually this is a question for both you guys, because I've always been interested in the parallels between boxing and chess, because they're both one-on-one sports, if you want to call chess a sport. They're both one-on-one, even though one is purely mental and one is physical. Still, I always thought there was that parallel. So I'm curious if you feel like there is that natural parallel that makes it fit together well. And also, I'm very curious about how it actually feels to play chess after, because I have no experience with that, after you've done something super physical and potentially painful. How does that feel to play one after the other?
Well, so I'll jump in on the first question. I think Canty's perfect to answer the second question, having just come out of the world championship. So I love when people see chess and boxing as opposites at first, because there's way more parallels and overlaps than initially meet the eye. You know, one is, like Fabi said, one is predominantly mental, the other is predominantly physical, but they both have mental and physical aspects to them. You know, if you aren't in good shape as a chess player, and you have, you know, not just a long game, but a long week full of games, you're going to fatigue. You're not going to play as well towards the end. There's a staying in physical shape component that affects your chest. And the equal opposite is true in boxing. If you're completely brain off, if you aren't learning from the mistakes of when your opponent lands a shot, if you aren't starting to break down and analyze and anticipate your opponent's movements, then you're going to be falling up behind. You have to use your brain in boxing. It's not a purely physical act. And even more granular, I love that both expressions are about controlling space and specifically controlling the center. We know that in chess, control the four center squares of the board. You can kind of dictate the pace of the match or make your opponent do things they don't want to do. But the same's true in boxing. It's called ring generalship. And if you can control the center of the ring, your opponent is forced to dance around the outside of you. And that uses more energy. They're covering more real estate when they move. You can also trap them up against the ropes or in corners and kind of stifle their movement, make them be somewhere they don't want to be. And so, you know, that space control is a common theme between the two. And then the last main one is pieces act like punches. You know, they work much better in combination. If you're just sending one piece behind enemy lines, it's probably not going to get too much accomplished. It's the same with one-off punches. You want to string them together into 3-4 punch combinations. You want to drill those a lot so you understand those synergies. It's the same as an outpost or the same as a battery in chess, where you want the pieces to be working together, not working in isolation.
AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at Rubrik.com. That's Rubrik.com.
And I like saying, you know, the punches themselves can also kind of be directly connected to pieces and punches. So your rooks, they go straight, just like straight shots. They're very powerful. Straight shots in boxing are your most powerful punches. It's what you want to use the most, especially later in the fight, just like in an endgame. Hooks are sneaky. They can sneak around defense, just like a knight. So that you can kind of surprise people with those. And then uppercuts come from a different angle. And oftentimes you don't see them come, and they're almost like snipers, like bishops. Maybe some of those are a little forced, but hopefully you get the sense that a lot of them are pretty aligned and similar between both expressions. And I'll let Canty jump in with the how does it feel to play chess after boxing around, because he just got a taste of that in Serbia.
Well, I would say you're also like a chess player that was a boxer first and foremost, and Canty is the opposite, right? He was a True. Chess player that became a boxer later on. So how do you see those parallels come together?
Yeah, actually, I spar a lot. So my sparring crew, I love my guys out there. Shout out to my guys, my coach Luke and them at Landshark MMA. You know, we came over from Legends Boxing, and then it unfortunately closed down. But then we moved over to Landshark MMA. So over there, I'm boxing. We got guys that come from other gyms because Luke was a fighter himself, and he had like I think 20 something fights, won like 18 of them by, you know, KO and submission and all this other stuff. He was really good. So we had one guy came over and he's like, yeah, man, you know, actually they got congratulations from everyone from being world champ. And they're like, yo, you know, boxing is human chess, basically. So it's really the same thing with certain ways that they stand or certain ways that, you know, you start to pick up on their patterns. And then when you pick up on the patterns as a chess player, you notice things that they like, so you can adjust to it and et cetera. Or you notice that they react when you throw this kind of punch or a feint. Okay, cool. You know, I'm able to like actually capitalize on that. So for me, honestly, the chess part was so easy. I'm not even gonna lie, because it's just what we do. Like, you know, it's just playing chess. Like, I've played 60,000 bullet games on chess.com alone, like, you know, so in the last year. So I play so much chess that I'm just blitzing out the moves, don't even care. And even when I'm tired, I still can calculate very well. I've even had a dream recently where I woke up mad because I lost the game in my sleep. And I'm like, dang, why am I mad, bro? Like, this is, it's not even real. It didn't happen, right? So it's just, it was easy. It was honestly easy. The chess part was very easy, especially even after the boxing part. I think Matt mentioned something on 60 Minutes about, like, basically that minute of calming down, you know, like right that minute in between rounds. That is where, okay, I was able to calm down and breathe and see the board. But I think if you don't have a lot of experience in the chess-wise and, like, playing thousands of games, it's going to be very hard for you to make that switch. For me, it was really easy. Even in between sets, when I'm working out at the gym, I'm playing bullet in between sets. So, like, I'm literally, I put the bar down and then I play bullet. You know, I've been doing that for years already. So, you know, I was kind of already ready for it. It was very easy.
So, I could jump in with a little bit more on, sure, on that. Let's take Canty's final match against Russia. It was the last fight of the tournament. It was probably the most hyped the arena had been the entire week because it all came to this one big climax between us fighting for second place. And Canty basically needed, we didn't know this at the time, but he needed to win in order for us to secure second place overall. Mm. And Russia, just, you know, we're rivals in chess boxing, but just rivals in general too. So they love beating Americans, and they had beaten us a lot and we'd beaten them a few times. But, the guy that Canty was fighting was a better boxer, just straight up.
The guy looked scary. I'm not gonna lie. I saw some footage of him. He looked scary.
He had boxed a lot more, and his strength was actually chess. He's one of the strongest chess players on Team Russia. And, you know, I'm sure.
What would you say his rating was? James, I mean, you probably know better.
He said he was like 2100, 22 online, something like that.
Yeah.
And I played a Joe Bava, and I'm like, okay, he's playing some good moves. He actually was slightly better at some point, too. Took a pawn or two. I just mixed it up and playing fast and flagging. But I was like, he's not bad at all, actually. So, yeah, his boxing was vicious, though. The man was coming with some very mean hooks. I had to dodge, and I hit him with a few, and he's not moving. I'm like, this is scary, right? So, yeah, he was okay.
So I'm a very unique position in chess boxing where, like, you know, I'm Team USA, and I'm totally biased, but I have to be unbiased when I commentate because mm-hmm. I'm ringside, and I'm calling the fight. So I remember one moment where the Russian caught Canty with a left hook about 30 seconds left in the round. I saw his eyes go, and this was the moment where I was like, okay, like, this is when champions are made. Like, is he going to fight back? Is he going to go down? Is he going to be able to recover and finish out on the board? Because the position at that time, maybe Canty was a little disadvantaged, but it was about equal. But he had done something no one in chess boxing had ever done before, which is in the first round, he only used 13 seconds of his clock. And he played to his big advantage, which is speed chess. And that down regulation that he's talking about, people may not understand, but when you're boxing, you're stuck in a caveman part of your brain, the part of your brain that kept us alive, you know, when bears were chasing us and we were constantly kind of in this fight or flight state called your amygdala. And that part of your brain is terrible at playing chess because it's all present tense focus. It's not mm-hmm. it's not able to think many steps ahead, if any steps ahead, because it's only focused on surviving right now. And so the more that you can do what Canty was talking about, which is down-regulate and make yourself feel safe, lower your heart rate, try to dump adrenaline out of your system, it frees up your brain's bandwidth to move from the back of your brain to the front of your brain, where your frontal lobe is, and specifically your prefrontal cortex, which is the part of the brain that lights up the most when you play chess. It's really good at pattern recognition and memory, but not just past tense stuff, but thinking moves ahead, calculating action and reaction. And so I think those reps that Canty was getting, where, you know, maybe he was weightlifting or maybe he was doing heavy bag rounds or sparring, and then always playing bullet chess in between, this is what saved Canty. And what made him a world champion, because it got hairy towards the end where, you know, a lot of pieces were coming off the board and Canty was essentially playing for that timeout, which is a great win condition for a build like him. But, you know, if he wasn't using the right part of his brain and if he wasn't able to recover as fast as he did, I don't know how that ends up. So, you know, kudos to the champ.
Well, I actually want to know about the strategy going into the match. Obviously, you knew who you were facing, Canty, but also as Matt just pointed out, during the match, what were your emotions at that point when you were getting, you know, hit in the head and then on the board, it was not looking as good perhaps as you wanted it to look?
Yeah, well, emotions wise, I was like, well, you know, I know he's getting me with some boxing here. I just need to make sure that I stay alive. I throw punches. I move my feet, listen to my corner, and just play, basically, and play fast, because I'm always good at that. And of course, when I wasn't like crushing him, I'm like, this isn't going the way I wanted to, but that's not a bad thing, right? So I'm still gonna play my best. Obviously, I was very optimistic about the whole thing. Still, you know, I know he was winning in some boxing rounds. I was able to catch him a few times, move around, and he caught me with some good ones. I was able to still move around, but I was like, yeah, this guy is a lot stronger boxing wise than I thought, basically, especially because I watched his film before. I didn't know he had, you know, I'm studying his film. I knew he had some good left hooks. I knew, you know, what I was up against, but I was still like optimistic about the entire thing. And, you know, I had a lot of fight, bro. I was like, yo, I'm not losing. I'm not going to lose. I went in there with that mindset, and like I boxed as best as I could. I learned a lot. Now my training is different because I do like 3 minute rounds of. I used to do like 2 minute rounds on bag and even sparring. Now I do like 3-4 minute rounds of just both, just to make sure I'm ready and my stamina is much better. So, you know, I'm training again already to hold my title. But I was a little scared when he came in, like, and he started swinging, and I'm like, oh, this man trying to kill me, right? So I was like blocking. I'm like, oh, that's a heavy hook, and then I have to duck under one, roll under the other one, slip to my right side, come up with an uppercut. I was catching him with nice counters because I'm very nice with countering, but the ones that he catch you with are mean. They're very mean. So then I was like, okay, I got to get back to this board. I just got to make it messy because I know I'm very good in messy positions, like tactics where they're flowing. You have to see everything at once. I'm very good at that. And like, so I knew that was going to be something that I could advance on and be good with and play fast, which he wasn't used to that either. So it really worked out at the end, though.
I feel a little bit out of my depth with you guys because I think you all have pretty extensive fighting experience. I mean, obviously, James and Matt, you guys clearly do. And Christian, you also did a lot of grappling and a lot of fighting as well. And I've taken like 10 hours of boxing lessons in my life. I'd say it was probably the best workout I ever did. It was my arms were dead. It was the toughest workout. And I just had this thought. I don't know if it makes much sense, but I'm wondering in general if chess boxing, like the really strong chess players who get into it, they just have this huge natural advantage over boxers who get into chess, because perhaps there's a bit, it's a bit easier to box defensively and to survive, and then there's no real way for an inferior chess player to survive on the board. But I might be completely off on that assessment.
It's a really important bill to talk about, especially on this podcast.
AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at Rubrik.com. That's Rubrik.com.
That's right. Mostly a chess audience. So you take someone like Canty that has a really good athletic base, already into fitness where he's doing weightlifting and starting to do boxing as a hobby and very, very high level in chess. That is an incredible starting build for a chess-leaning chess boxer. But you know, Canty's a unicorn. There aren't many chess players built like Canty. So, you know, let's take someone like William Grafe as an example. He's a FIDE master. He's a two-time New York State champion, and he represented Team USA this year in the 65-kilogram weight division. When he started out and found out about chess boxing about a year ago, he was closer to 135 pounds. So he put on almost 25 pounds of muscle in about a year, just dedicating himself to training boxing and starting to weightlift and build muscle. And I would still put him at like maybe an 1100, 1200 level boxer if we're using chess ELO kind of equivalencies. But what we were able to do with him is teach him how to jab, teach him how to protect his chin, and just stay away from people, to essentially make it a cat and mouse game in the ring so that he could exercise his advantage on the board. And with some people, that'll work. If you have the athleticism and the coachability to be able to stay away, that kind of strategy can work. But eventually you're going to meet someone that can survive your chess and draw it out and wear you out in boxing and track you down and knock you out. And it doesn't have to be, you know, a knockout cold to win the match. It can be a 3 stoppage in a round or 4 stoppage in a fight that leads to TKO. And TKOs can come from just not either intelligently defending yourself or not throwing any counters. So you can't just sit there and cover, because the ref's going to stop in and give you one of those standing eight counts that maybe if you've watched a boxing match before, you've seen them kind of step in and give a boxer a break to be able to recompose himself to get back into the fight. So the build that Fabi's describing is my preferred build, because I like that style of fight. Is, you know, come and get me, because you know if you let me get back to the board, I'm going to decimate you. But it is the riskier build, because on the chessboard you don't risk physical injury, you don't risk head trauma. So, you know, what the boxer who's just learning chess doesn't risk is, you know, if anything gets injured at all, it's their ego. You know, they get blown off the board and whatever, they go back to the gym.
And I think that's the biggest cost of entry for chess players turning into boxers. They're like, you know, I'm making a little bit, especially professional chess players like James, right? He's going into boxing. He could get hit in the head. You don't know what happens after, right? You could be losing the way that you're making your living by just going into this sport. Like, how do you handle that? How do you still encourage chess players to take on chess boxing, given the risks?
It's the most important part of the chess boxer's mindset to get right, especially from a coaching standpoint, right? You know, I get a lot of questions from chess players of, what do you think the likelihood or the probability is that I get a concussion or that I break my nose or whatever? And my answer is always, it's 100%. 100% you're going to get a concussion. 100% you're going to break your nose. You're going to break your jaw. And you have to know that going in and be okay with that 100% possibility in order to be an effective chess boxer. No, you're going to be damaged.
Matt, you got to move your head, Matt. Move your head. Move your head. No, but I understand that completely.
If I can make a fighter okay with, hey, yeah, I know I'm going to be damaged and I'm going to do it anyway, then we can work with that. If they're going in with the fear that, oh, there's a 35% chance that I get a concussion that affects the way that I go through the rest of my life,
yeah,
then there's always a seed of doubt and a shadow of fear that they're operating in. So we really have to be clear that you have to be okay with a worst case scenario. You have to understand that that's not just a possibility, but like, put yourself in the situation where this happens and basically regret proof yourself, you know?
How did you handle, James, those risks, those inherent risks with boxing? How did you handle
honestly,
that switch
me,
in mentality?
Yeah, I just trained, bro. I'm not even going to lie. For me, I trained a lot. So I was very comfortable with basically not getting hit in the face in a way. I sparred a lot. I sparred, you know, at least once or twice a week for a good 2 years. Matt was like, yo, you need to do more hard sparring. So I went, I did some hard sparring, right? It was tough. It was just, you had to get used to it. And for me, I knew that I don't want to get hit as loud, you know, so I learned, if you see, especially when you go back to the film, he was still able to catch me in both matches, actually, too. And I was able to drop the bigger guy, the Uzbekistan player or player fighter who had like 20 years of boxing experience. I didn't even know that. Matt told me that after the match. So, you know, but it was a thing where I knew I had to move my head. So I studied players. I studied fighters that were moving their head a lot, like Canelo's. I would do a lot of drills with triangle drills. Move your head, try in a triangle. Try to do that a lot. I would practice at home, practicing slipping and rolling. And then when I'm sparring, I would be doing the same thing. So I film with me like blocking and then blocking a six-punch combo, get out the way, move your head, right? I was doing all of this and being prepared because I was like, when they throw in punches, I want to be ready. Because you don't want to sit there and just take the punches and just, and you getting ate up and you're going to get knocked out or you get some serious damage. So another fighter I liked was Shakur Stevenson that I studied, where he moves his feet a lot. He doesn't like to hit to get hit. He's more of a Mayweather. Hit and get and don't get hit. It's the name of, you know, some pro boxing in a way. So I studied a lot of that. So I was very confident in the hard work, just as chess players, that's how kind of hard we are too as well. You study, you study and you trust in your hard work and good things tend to happen. So I was the same there with that.
Fabi, did you ever consider taking on chess boxing? I mean, especially after 2021 or 2022, whenever we had that event with Ludwig, right? I think that was kind of the big turnaround. 2022, yeah. Yes. And you were explaining kind of that whole strategy of perhaps surviving the boxing and then winning in the chess. I think that was exactly what happened in that match between Andrea Botas, who was trying to survive in chess, and who was it?
Dina.
Who did she?
Dina,
yes. And Dina obviously was trying to survive in boxing and barely survived in boxing and then went on to checkmate Andrea and win the match. So,
well, but that was actually controversial because it was later ruled a TKO.
Yeah.
And then they decided to share it because of the controversy. Were you guys at that match?
I co-produced that event. I co-commentated it with Levy and Ludwig. And I made the match between Andrea and Dina. I connected with Dina at a chess boxing France event called the IFC. She co-commentated with me and she said, "Hey, there's this influencer that's thinking about doing a chess boxing event. You should reach out to him." So I sent Ludwig a cold DM like 2.5 months before the event. And within 15 minutes, we were on a call. He responded almost immediately. They were having a lot of trouble with the event. They couldn't insure it and they couldn't sanction it. And then I was able to join the team, get it sanctioned, get it insured. And then he made me a co-commentator. But I can share a little bit of, I don't know if this has been shared publicly either, but I can share a little bit of background on that Dina Andrea decision.
Please do.
Especially since
it's
like 3 years after, it doesn't really matter anymore.
Why not?
Straight up, you know, sorry, Andrea, but Dina won that fight. You know, she was not damaged enough to have like the stoppage that we, you know, post fight called it for Andrea. Like she survived that round. She was way up in chess. She checkmated Andrea, and controversy is great for bringing more attention to it. That at the time was the best fight of that night and the most viewed chess boxing event in history. So it was fantastic for us to have that kind of controversy and then to kind of after the fight call it a draw, which both ladies agreed that was fair. Andrea, you know, we kind of had like a discussion with me, Lud, Andrea, and Dina about what to do. And everyone kind of agreed, hey, this feels the best, even though my position was, you know, Dina won the fight. So the referee in charge there has some of the blame. He's a friend. He was a new referee, a guy named Martin, because he kind of jumped in quickly, which led to the stoppage that was in question, which led to the TKO. But that shows a really good yin and yang kind of chess boxing match where you know, one person clearly has an advantage in one but can survive in the other, and the vice of, you know, the antithesis is true too. So I love matches like that where you know kind of what the game plan is and what someone has to execute, and you're just seeing if they're able to execute on that plan.
Actually, that leads me to a related question. First of all, I was very skeptical about chess boxing when we went into that event, but I really enjoyed that fight in particular. There were a lot of fights that night. Some were better than others, but that one I thought was a truly entertaining and fun.
Menards Black Friday sale is here. Get everything you need to bring home the holidays. A Nerf Blaster dog toy blasts tennis balls 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing squish lamps and Performax drill bit sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Hurry in while supplies last. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
And very close. Even with the controversy, still a great one to watch. Or perhaps even aided by the controversy. but there was another fight that night, which was Lawrence Trent was fighting Amon Hambleton. And I'm wondering if you also feel like that stoppage was perhaps also controversial. Because to me, I was wondering if that was the right time to stop the match, if it was already dangerous for Lawrence physically, or if perhaps he could still go on, and you think that maybe it was a bit too early.
That was absolutely the right stoppage. I was really pleased with that match because the thought with that matchup was maybe they'll play a little patty cake because neither of them have ever boxed before, and it'll be really good chess. And what ended up happening was a first boxing round knockout. And mm-hmm. and Amon just landed a really nice overhand right that actually stunned Lawrence, actually put him down. And you don't see that very often with people that haven't trained boxing. It takes not just strength like what Canty has, but it takes technique and timing in order to be able to land that shot at the right time in the right place to do the damage needed to lead to a KO. And so I was so impressed with Amon's ability to, in a relatively short time horizon, to do the training necessary to land a shot like that. It was amazing.
Speak of that technically, because Amon, for this, but he looked horrible in the videos preceding that that match. Like, he was looking way out of touch with the boxing part. And I was expecting exactly the same thing. I was expecting Lawrence, with some more experience, to potentially take over in the boxing, and then Amon to try to take over in the chess. It was completely the opposite. What did you see from a technical perspective in that match that made Amon so dangerous? Was he just swinging? Was he powerful? Was his mentality in the right place? What was it?
I have to give Amon his flowers here for a couple of reasons. One, when Ludwig brought me onto the team, one of my roles was also to make sure everyone was trained up and ready, which, you know, 2 months out from the event, not, and me being mostly remote, you know, not able to physically train with people, it was basically just me watching film and trying to inform people like we're talking now. You know, I'd watch film with them. I'd break it down. I'd go in slow motion. And no one set up more sessions with me than Amon. You know, he was training with high-level boxers in his boxing gym. That's why maybe if you saw the sparring footage, he looked so bad. He was fighting real people, which isn't good for your confidence because you're always going to lose those, but it is great for your progression. So he didn't lean into like, oh, I'll just fight easy guys and feel like I'm doing well and feel like I'm a better boxer than I actually am. No, he threw himself in the deep end. And most of the time, his sparring partner was his coach's son, who's a good technical boxer. So when he did land shots, he knew that he earned them. And there's a neurological kind of dopamine loop that occurs when you do something right, and it hits different when you actually earn doing the thing right rather than someone letting you do it right. There's something that fires off. So I think his ability to immediately start training hard, sparring hard, actually starting to earn shots that landed that were similar to the shots that eventually landed on Lawrence, I think he just programmed his training camp and optimized for improving as quickly as possible in a really good way. Of course, he's still like a novice level boxer, but he was fighting another novice level boxer. So in terms of how they both prepared, obviously Amon out-prepared him and then outperformed him when it mattered.
I love it. James, speaking of you and your preparation, and perhaps Matthew, you can join in at some point with the technical details of what you see. Obviously, you've been doing a lot of bodybuilding. You've been lifting a lot. You're a big guy, right? Sometimes that doesn't equate to good boxing. And it's, in fact, something that hinders your boxing. Because in boxing, you have to be fast. You have to have stamina. How did you make that transition from being a guy that was training to look good, to put on mass and to grow muscles, to one that, you know, you have to be fast, you have to have the stamina ready as well? How did you make that transition?
So, yeah, the transition was actually, honestly, it was hard at first to learn because I have more muscle. So having more muscle, obviously, is just harder for you to move around and stuff like that. So nowadays, I'm cutting down a lot. And I'm down like 10, 15 pounds already. So that's really helped me, basically. Just eating better and like doing more cardio. But it was difficult because I had more mass. Even in some of the videos now from September, I was actually up a little bit of weight, you know. So now I'm down that weight, which is I love. You know, I love that I'm down weight now. So I know I'm gonna be much quicker, you know. So it's hard because you do have the muscle, the mass and stuff like that. So I know my hooks and straights and even my jabs can be very heavy. Because I'm heavier and stuff like that, but it is slower. You're slower. I noticed that I was actually quicker for my size, so that helped out, but it also was tiring. Of course, a lot of movement I'm making, the more muscles I have, like, it was tiring. So nowadays, I am trying to cut down to actually maybe even compete in another weight class, but maybe not too much. I'll still probably be over lightweight, so I'll still be over super heavyweight is what I'll be in, but not at 235, you know, which is what I was weighing. I'm more like 215 is something like that. That's my goal.
So 215 will be a different weight class. It'll be cruiserweight. Anything under 220. So if, you know, just heads up there, we can have that conversation later, can't we? So a couple things about his build in particular. One, what he said about mobility is absolutely spot on. The more bulk you have, generally the less you're able to fully extend, fully bring back. You just have these big biceps in the way. And really what you want is in boxing is smaller biceps and then really active triceps, really strong triceps, because it's mostly a push kind of motion. And the other side of that bulk is muscles require a lot of fuel, a lot of energy. And so very basic kind of movements, you're using incrementally more and more energy than your opponent's using if they have less bulk, just because your muscles have more of kind of a base burn of how many calories it takes, how much, you know, how much blood it requires from your heart, how hard your heart has to work as a result. So you get gassed out a lot faster. And I'll go ahead and plug what just happened and really why we're doing this episode. But 60 Minutes just did a feature on Team USA Chess Boxing and the last bit of it is Canty's fight. Mm-hmm. And I love the interview where Canty basically sits down in the corner and Bill Whitaker is interviewing him. And Canty's still catching his breath because he just came out of the ring and just won a world championship. And you can see on his face and you can hear in his voice the effect that one boxing round, one 3-minute round against this guy had on Canty. And you know, part of that is Canty's build and being in super heavyweight, but part of that is just it is a difficult thing to do to go 100% effort against another person that's going 100% effort against you. It's one thing to hit a heavy bag or to do some light sparring. It's another thing to both of you are really trying to knock each other's heads off. You push each other to a level that neither of you have ever been to before. And that's what I think is special about combat sports in general, but specifically chess boxing, because you're having to do that in both realms, not just biologically or physically with boxing, but mentally too. Can you recover in time? Can you get back in the chess part of your brain, and can you find your way to checkmate?
Yeah, and for me, I've done some sparring a little bit. I used to do kickboxing, and then we were doing some boxing rounds occasionally as well. That was many years ago, until I decided not to do any of that because of the hits to the head, to be honest. And that's probably why I'm still reluctant to try chess boxing, just because of the hits to the head. But I remember the fight and flight. Yeah,
maybe this will be a funny story for you guys too. But do you remember that at one training camp we had? You boxed someone else from our... You remember
this? Yes, I boxed you as well.
Well, no, we didn't really. I mean,
not really, but we did box a little bit. Yes.
But we had this training camp, and I don't even know how it started, but Christian and another guy who we were working with at the camp decided to box, and then we had a round of boxing in the garden after
with
the
chess. Rustam.
Yeah, with Rustam. I wasn't sure if... But yeah, with Rustam.
No, I think that's public knowledge.
Yeah. Well, now it is. Anyway, sorry, just a small anecdote.
No, I do remember that. I definitely do remember that. Just because, I mean, look, whenever we're in training, especially during one of those long camps, you try to mix things that are fun in, and boxing is definitely fun. And you are doing pretty well, Fabi, I have to say. I mean, you are very... very accurate with your striking as well, and I think you would be quite good at it just because of your build. But I don't want you to get hit in the head too much. I think you need it way more than everybody else on this podcast right now. But I kind of lost the train of thought that I had. But I think what I wanted to mention was those moments in between rounds. That 1 minute goes by so fast.
Menards Black Friday sale is here. Get everything you need to bring home the holidays. A Nerf Blaster dog toy blasts tennis balls 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing squish lamps and Performax drill bit sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Hurry in while supplies last. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
And your mind is still just like running. It's fight or flight mode type of situation. And what you should be focused on at that point is just catching your breath and managing to take down your heart rate. And if you can manage to do that, and I know, Matt, you specifically said that 1 minute in between rounds is so crucial to your performance. Why is that from your perspective?
Yeah, thanks for that question. So the sport is still very young, and innovations in the sport are still happening rapidly. And so one of my contributions to the sport is treating the minute in between rounds like another arena, like another competition. So you have 60 seconds to get an advantage over your opponent. And how do you do that? So let's take a boxing round transitioning to a chess round. You've just done 3 minutes of very high heart rate, high adrenaline kind of activity. And as soon as that bell rings, what we train to do is to treat it like a Pavlovian response. So if you've heard of Pavlov's dog, a scientist named Pavlov rings a bell, trains his dog that every time he rings the bell, it's dinner time. So now, even when it isn't dinner time, he can ring the bell and the dog's mouth starts salivating. What we do is we try to weave in as many Pavlovian responses to our training as possible. So as soon as we hear that bell, we don't even have to think about our response at the end of a boxing round. We immediately start slow pattern breathing. And the way that you start training slow pattern breathing is by slowing down your exhale. You want to exhale about twice as long as you inhale, and then try to make that exhale as long as possible. What that does is it signals to your brain and to your central nervous system that it's okay to exit sympathetic and enter parasympathetic. And parasympathetic is your rest and restore kind of mode for your nervous system. So as soon as you're able to enter that, let's say you enter it 5 or 10 seconds before your opponent does, you start that process of then shifting your brain's bandwidth from the back of your brain to your front of the brain more quickly. So breath is the first step. As you start that breathing process, you're walking over to your corner, holding out your hands because your corner man has to take off your gloves. As soon as you get over to the corner, hold your hands out, eyes closed, and you start visualizing the board and ideally the last position that you remember. So you can start assessing it without physically being at the board. Mm-hmm. What that does is it changes the temporal spatial part of your brain to 3D, like from the 3D kind of like punches come at you, you dodging and trying to land a shot, to the more 2D chess. I'm analyzing the position. I'm starting to calculate et cetera. And then the last piece is we want to start to weave in nonverbal cues or inner voice affirmations. And these are different for everyone. So I work with each individual fighter on what they can pull from their past or from their training that they can summon in that moment to tailor all that busy mind that you're talking about, Christian, all that chatter that's going on. Oh, you know, I shouldn't have let him land that shot. Oh, you know, all the anxiety, all the, you know, worries that are bombarding you in that moment. You want to drown out with one word over and over again. And it's again, so it's different for everyone, but what it does is it starts to train your brain and your body to, when I breathe this way, when I close eyes, visualize, and when I say this thing over and over to myself, I'm a chess player. I am a completely a different person than who I was, 50 seconds ago when I was in the ring. And we have the same process after a chess round into a boxing round. That's just the equal opposite. It's upregulation, fast pattern breath, close eyes visualization of how your opponent moves, and a different word that psychs you up and revs you up and gets you ready to be back in that fighter mindset.
That's so interesting, because whenever you talk about that, it sort of reminds me of the way we treat this type of knockout events. And right now the World Cup is happening, which is a knockout event, but all these transitions from losing a game in rapid and then having to bounce back, then moving from rapid to blitz, it's a completely different game. You don't have a lot of time to try to create a new strategy. You need to be able to sort of adapt on the fly. And I want to bring Fabio into conversation on this one, because he has the most experience with this type of situations, right? And he's played just a recent match against MVL, which kind of resembles those type of emotions. Blitz, rapid, being down in the blitz and then coming back and then just having 5 minutes in between to sort your thoughts and perhaps even prepare a little bit. What do you do in those few minutes in between rounds, Fabi? And this is only chess related, right? There's no boxing involved, but I feel it's somewhat similar as well.
That's why I mentioned or asked about the parallels between chess and boxing, because although I don't know much about boxing, I have no boxing experience, I can easily imagine that it's a very mental sport as well. Aside from the fact that it's purely physical, you still have to manage your emotions. I mean, my understanding of basically everything is that if you're not in the right headspace, it doesn't matter whether it's something that doesn't require physical effort like chess, or something that does require maximum physical effort. You have to be focused, and if you're not, that you can't perform well. And also, of course, if we've even like basic exercise, even lifting, if your mind is somewhere else, even something which doesn't require the complexities of trying to beat someone else in a competition, just moving weight it seems like the simplest thing in the world, right? You can't do it well unless your head is in the right space. Mm-hmm. So when it comes to chess, I can easily imagine that. And again, with chess, I mean, we all know that if you're feeling bad, if you're distracted, if something wrong is going on, that, you know, you can't focus on chess because, you know, something bad happened, then it's going to be really difficult to play. And in chess, the something bad happening is that you lost a game, right? Mm-hmm. It's very hard to recover from that psychologically. I think we've all been in that position. You lose a game, you get tilted. Probably our viewers could also relate to that, right? It's when you're playing a match or a tournament and you just lost a game and now you have to play another one, how do you handle that? How do you forget about the past game? It's probably, when it comes from a psychological point of view, not the purely chess skill part of it, one of the most important things to master in chess, and you guys can speak to the mental part. You guys can speak to whether it's the same in chess boxing, but I would heavily suspect that it's similar, right? That you can't let Like, let's say something bad happened on the board. You can't let that affect now what's going to happen in the ring, right? You have to kind of separate the past with the present. At least that's my impression of it.
Yeah, it's super interesting. I have questions for you around that, if I can turn it around in a second here. But I didn't realize how much this applied to other walks of life. You know, I figured out my version of it when I was competing in chess boxing. But it wasn't until actually an opportunity from Danny Rensch to speak at MIT and the Sloan Sports Analytics Conference, where Canty came with me to do a chess boxing demonstration. It wasn't until having to prepare for that talk that I started to realize, oh, we're all constantly going through transitions. We're all constantly having to deal with things that are distracting from the task at hand, especially now with, you know, these things in our pockets and constantly, you know, notifying us and pulling us out of any kind of flow state we hopefully can achieve. That transition resilience turns into a really important skill to develop in today's day and age, even if you're not a chess player or a chess boxer. Mm-hmm. And it kind of inadvertently launched a part of my career that's not now my main focus. The someone in the crowd for that talk was the director of health and wellness for the NBA. Shout out Gael. And she hired me to start to coach NBA referees on this exact thing. And if you take a referee or a judge's experience, the parallel of that to chess boxing is actually way more one-to-one than someone would anticipate. You're running up and down the court as an NBA referee. You have 20,000 people that have their eyes on you. So you're in performance mode. People are judging you. And you have a 7-foot giant who's mad at you after a call that you maybe got right, mm-hmm. maybe got wrong, but could smash you in a second if he wanted to. Your life is in danger. You know, they probably won't act on it in front of 20,000 people, but you still feel that kind of in the caveman part of your brain. And you're asking an NBA referee in that kind of state, mostly acting from your amygdala, to make decisions based off of memory, of all their training and all the past games that they've seen, and pattern recognition, just like chess. So especially when a play is challenged, we have the same kind of
Menards Black Friday sale is here. Get everything you need to bring home the holidays. A Nerf Blaster dog toy blasts tennis balls 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious to buy chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing squish lamps and Performax drill bit sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Hurry in while supplies last. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
Opportunity for a Pavlovian response. You hear that challenge whistle. You have to go over to the booth and review the play. What do you do on that walk over to the booth? What are you saying to yourself? How are you breathing? These are things before a year ago that no NBA referee was focusing on, that now I have one-on-ones with NBA referees to develop their own kind of priming procedures to start to get into the right headspace to make the right call the second time or while they're in the game or when someone's, you know, yelling at them that they're going to do terrible things to their mom or, you know, racial slurs or whatever at some of these referees. How do you tune that out, stay focused on what you need to stay focused on? And I, you know, I would love to dig deeper into the traditional chess kind of version of this, because I'm sure there's a lot of gains that could be made in just the mental fortitude and resilience that comes into play, especially over the course of something like a freestyle, which Fabi's about to go to in South Africa, where you have multiple competitions over the course of the week. Sometimes, you know, last minute changes happen where it was going to be one time control and is it different, a different one or, you know, whatever. How do you not let that stuff affect you, or at least have it affect you less than your opponent, so you gain a little advantage? And so my long-winded preface into the question for Fabi is, what kind of priming procedures or habits do you have on a game day or right before you walk out to the board and adjust your pieces or whatever? Is there anything that you do that maybe isn't a competitive advantage where you're tipping off other people, but how do you make sure that you're you're zoned in. You're primed to play at your best.
Yeah, I think. Well, first of all, it is a very interesting subject in general, and I think that chess players, even top professional chess players, have in some ways, like, I don't feel our approach has always been the most professional compared to other athletes, and that we haven't made the most use of not just, you know, the working on openings and all that stuff that everyone does, but the psychological aspect, the kind of neuroscience behind it. This is relatively unexplored in chess. And so the common routine for people playing chess when you have time, when you know your opponent, you have one game a day. You know, a lot of chess tournaments are two games a day. You know your opponent 10 minutes before, but let's say you know your opponent a day before, a week before. That often happens in high level events. And a lot of the preparation is just opening preparation. And I've given it some thought because very often you do all this opening work and you don't see it on the board. There was also this Dubov interview. Perhaps you saw it connected to the World Cup, where he said he prepared 10 minutes and not more than that. James, I see you smiling, so you probably noticed.
Yeah, he was super. He was. That was great. That was a great interview. I was like, wow, that's crazy.
He was BSing.
And we discussed it a bit in the previous episode. And it's true, like, maybe you prepare your openings and you don't get it on the board and you think, well, what's the point? But then I was also thinking, maybe the preparation aspect is not just about if you get your prep on the board, but also it kind of primes you to get ready for it. Like, I'm working for an hour before the game, repeating my openings, looking for ideas, thinking about what can or can't happen in the game. And that actually primes me psychologically to get ready for the game. And if I just, instead of that, I, you know, go for a swim, go for a jog, have a long lunch, maybe I'm not psychologically primed because my routine is always that I do this preparation, and it kind of tells my body, my mind, whatever, it's time to play. And it gets kind of provokes that stress response that we're all familiar with, the butterflies or however it manifests for you, but feeling right before the game, like, okay, I'm really nervous. I think we've all been there as well. And I can't imagine in chess boxing, the nervousness is probably intensified greatly, because it's also like, okay, now I'm about to get hit, right? It's a lot more intensive. But I think that that kind of primes you for it. And the rest, in terms of how do I deal psychologically with what may happen during the game? The potential mistakes, the emotional swings, or what may happen in a tournament, the losses, the missed opportunities, the bad breaks. That, I think, comes with experience. And it's very hard the first time. I can't tell you anything someone playing a tournament for the first time that will help them be ready for the losses or the disappointments, because you're going to need tournaments, years possibly of experience to get ready for that, the painful aspects. And the more it happens, maybe you could speak to this. Is it kind of similar to, like, if you tried to punch me in the face, I would never be ready for that psychologically. But if someone's if you've had to deal with that repeatedly, do you ever get used to it? Like, do you ever get comfortable with the possibility that I'm about to get punched in the face?
Mm-hmm. Exposure therapy. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's why when Canty was sending me his early sparring, where he looked great, but they were doing all light sparring, I was like, listen, champ, like, good start, but start getting hit. Because getting hit is a skill. Learning how to take hits is a skill. And everyone, when they start boxing, they'll flinch a little bit when a fist comes close to their face, even if they miss it, they're still flinching. Their eyes still close a little bit. It affects vision. It affects energy levels. It affects mindset. So exposure therapy, the more reps you get in something, the better you get at it. The same thing that you were saying earlier, it's like this probably comes with experience. It's harder at the beginning. It's the same as true, not just with chess boxing, but every walk of life. But not all reps are created equal too. So, you know, the more that you can mimic competition in your training, the more prepared for a competition you're going to be. So trying to control every single variable where, you know, maybe if you're like me and no one else was chess boxing in America in 2017, 2018, when I was training, you know, it'd be easy for me to go into the boxing gym and just use my phone to play blitz games in between rounds. But what I needed to do was bring a chess player with a physical chessboard and a physical clock in order to get the tactile feedback of taking my hands out of gloves, making moves with my wrapped hands after slamming them into a bag or slamming them into another person, feeling the tremors, getting the reps of getting used to a over the board experience again. And you can always tell the people in the world championship who only trained online, because they're usually the ones not hitting their clock and getting to a time disadvantage. They're usually the ones that are dropping pieces because they're not used to their hands shaking and not, you know, and being wrapped and being a little bulkier, and it's not as easy to make the moves. And so, you know, it's one example, but there are a thousand of them, of just the more state specific reps that you can get in an activity, the better you're going to get at that activity. It's super simple, super basic, super straightforward, but it's the truest thing in any kind of competition or skill acquisition.
That's so interesting to hear that from you, because when I felt I made the biggest progress when I was kickboxing is when I got used to actually not being afraid of getting hit. And that took, I think, maybe a year and a half to 2 years of actually sparring 3-4 days a week. So it wasn't an easy step for me. It took a long time to actually get used to that and be able to mentally be ready to counter. You know, like Conti says, he's always the counter striker, right? Like, being in that mindset doesn't come easy and doesn't come fast. Now, speaking of protocols to prime yourself for competition, and I think you sort of mentioned working with NBA referees. Give me a simple protocol that you're training with your referees right now. Give me like a 2-3-5-step protocol that you implement with them.
Sure. So I'll give you an NBA one that'll be short, mm-hmm. and then I'd love to give you one that is more applicable to you and your career and your play, specifically Fabi. So first with NBA referees, with one of my clients right now, of course, remain unnamed. He's dealing with a lot of personal life stuff that is coming with him onto the court. And he's struggling with confidence. So one thing that we've implemented for him is the same kind of power word that we use in chess boxing, from chess going into boxing or vice versa. We've built around the word statue for him. So we've done an extensive amount of exposure therapy with closed eyes meditation, where I'm leading him through a visualization of a real game experience, sometimes pulling on things that have actually happened. Sometimes I'm creating scenarios that could happen that are realistic. And we're creating neural pathways. We're kind of digging into grooves where, when those types of things happen in a game and in the moment where it matters, he's already gotten at least the mental reps, if not the experiential state-specific reps, that he's able to just rely on his subconscious to take over, start repeating statue, let all of this, you know, words or anger or spit or whatever just bounce off him. And he's still able to do what he knows is right, based off of his training, based off of, you know, whatever the scenario demands. And I think something that's specific to you guys and something that you've talked about on the show, and Fabi, I know you and I discussed this in Las Vegas during freestyle, is this kind of emerging phenomenon in the chess world where now there's live audiences and you can hear those live audiences while you're playing. This is something that all of your reps in the past are not going to be able to help you with this new reality of where chess may be going. So all of these things that used to kind of be in your favor, where it's complete silence, there aren't distractions, now you're getting bombarded with new stimuli. You can hear when maybe you make a good move or a bad move, there's an audible reaction from the crowd, and all these things that are just kind of throwing you off your modus operandi, your default kind of operating system. I'd love to experiment with, you know, let's just say, you know, it's going the direction where it's going to be very difficult to change. You know, there's going to be live audiences. There's going to be reactions. We just accept that. Then how do we use that as your advantage over people that aren't adapting as quickly, that aren't able to overcome accepting the new norm, the new truth? How do you turn it into something that is now your competitive advantage, where you've gotten way more reps and time scrambles with people yelling or being around you or trying to get you out of focus, and you're just ironclad. You're a statue. You're an assassin with low time. And you know, it'd be fun to like think through scenarios like that, either over the course of a chess tournament or in specific game moments, like a time scramble with a live audience, where we can start to build those priming procedures into your training. So it's not just opening prep, it's also pressure prep or whatever.
And actually, let's develop on that subject a little bit, because we do have a lot of viewers that do play competitively and do go to tournaments. Perhaps they lose a game or perhaps they win a game, because, you know, you need to rebalance yourself even when you win a game, not only when you lose a game. Let's say you have a game starting in 3 minutes. Let's add the audience as well. Yeah, you're coming off of stage. The audience is buzzing with excitement, and now you have 3 minutes to get ready for your next game. What would you do if you were, let's say, a trainer next to a top competitor such as Fabi in those 3 minutes?
So 3 minutes is more than enough time to affect your central nervous system. And it takes three things. It takes first the self-awareness to diagnose where you are in that moment. And it's very different after a win than a loss. It's very different than, you know, a game that isn't as meaningful versus one that matters, you know, for your overall standings in the tournament or for your career, or for prize money. So the first step is assessing exactly where I am. And second step is where I want to be. So I feel very keyed up. I feel very, maybe I'm overconfident because I just upset someone, or I won. I feel like I'm the man. And I need to bring myself down a little bit, like, because I'm too jittery. I'm too, my heart rate is too high. We can build a down regulation procedure that takes you back to a neutral state of just like, this is where I play my best chess, where I'm relaxed. I feel a little bit of nervous anxiety because that's inevitable. Like Fabi was talking about,
it's a good
with
thing.
This kind
it's
of fear
thing.
State of like, okay, I'm ready to perform. But I'm not so lost in that I'm just, you know, constantly anxiously second guessing myself, and, you know, I'm up against Magnus. I can never beat Magnus. Oh my God, Magnus. Like, you can cut that out. You can repeat one word. You can start to breathe in a certain way that brings you to a state that you want to be in. The one size fits all is slow pattern breathing, down regulation, fast pattern breathing, up regulation. If you're feeling drowsy, you didn't get great sleep, you're just kind of out of it, maybe you went out the night before, you're hungover, whatever, that upregulation is going to be your best friend, because it's going to key you up. It's going to get you more into a competitive mindset. It's going to make you a little bit more jittery and anxious. So depending on where you are and where you want to be, that third step is specifically tailoring a training program to someone to understand what's in their biological and neurological tool belt, and when to use those tools. So it's just like anything else. It's understanding what's at your disposal, learning how to use it, and then recognizing the moment where a certain tool is the best thing for that certain job.
And Fabi, I want to throw it back to you, because I feel 2018, when we were getting ready for the match against Magnus, one of the different things that you did was you really focused on your breath work going into the match. Like, you were doing a lot of yoga, and did you feel like that helped you? And right now we're hearing sort of kind of the same stories coming from Gukesh camp, for example, as well. He has this trainer that's helping him stay grounded using breath work, most likely. Now, enough affirmations as well. Fabi, did you feel like this is something that's important and could impact your play as well?
I think that it was good that I got into yoga. I don't practice for many years now. And it wasn't my initiative at the time. It was Rustav again. He was getting into it, and I decided to give it a try. Actually, I first gave it a try because I had this back injury. I don't know if you remember during our first camp for the candidates, I had this lower back. It was just minor, like a twinge that was bothering me. And then I just started doing some basic yoga to try to recover in a safe way, which helped physically. And for me, the breath work was always so difficult. I just can't naturally breathe. All these different types of breath work that happen in yoga that anyone who practices yoga is very familiar with is so challenging for me. I just naturally, I hold my breath during intense moments. Obviously, chest is one of those intense moments. And it's probably a common, I mean, I'm not a big expert in this, but it's probably a common thing that people hold their breath when they're in this very intense, like, time trouble phase or something where everything's going to be decided in the next 2 minutes, you know, it's where there's a lot of stress and anxiety and all that. So I think it was helpful. And I didn't give it up for any specific reason. It just kind of shifted to other things, other types of the workouts that I got interested in, other types of exercises that I got interested in, including for a brief period, boxing. I mentioned I took about 10 hours of boxing lessons just to try something different. It was a few years ago. And like for me, any kind of physical exercise or learning to use your body in different ways, I think is all great. There's like, I've never regretted trying a different sport, even though I'm obviously terrible at all of them. I've still never regretted trying a new sport or learning a new physical skill. I think it's all interconnected. It all works together. Okay. I mean, it's a lot of related things, even if not directly connected. Even things that are like chess and boxing, even things that are not they don't have to share the physicality. Even those, you can find a lot of parallels. So, all these things I felt were helpful.
James, I have to ask you as well, because obviously, you know, we know you as a very hyper guy from your videos, your bullet sessions. How do you ground yourself? Do you use any breath work? Did you get into that as well?
Yeah, I did actually. I remember it was a UFC coach guy that he wanted to try it with chess players, basically. And it was like box breathing. I did a lot of it of like six seconds inhaling and then 6 seconds, sometimes up to 8 exhaling and then holding for 4 seconds afterwards to like either control my breathing and also just to calm myself down, also doing it in a sauna. So I did a lot of that. That helps. And I still do that today. Like I'll inhale for 6 seconds or as long as I can, then hold actually for 4 seconds. And then I exhale for the same amount, 6 to 7, sometimes more. I exhale until all the breath's out of my lungs. And then I would hold that for 4 seconds before doing it again. We also practice stuff like, what would we do? He said, walk it. So I would breathe. I would start walking. And then I would inhale and then I would exhale everything. And as soon as I stopped exhaling, actually I was paused, I would be sitting or standing, not moving yet. And then I would take a breath, exhale, and then walk after you've exhaled. So you wanted to see how far you could walk. I forgot why we would do that, but it was something that kind of helped strengthen the lungs, to say the least, basically. So that worked a lot. I think it still helps today when I'm like in a stressful situation from like either, you know, boxing, sometimes chess and trading, right? You know, breathing, you got to control that breath work. This is very serious. So I understand that it helped me a lot. Even it was easier said than done when I was boxing and the world champion box in Serbia. It was hard. I was like, man, trying to do that and trying to catch your breath at the same time was incredibly hard. But it was, you know, the chess part was easy because the chess was so connected. I'm so connected chess-wise. When I sat down, I saw everything, even though I could barely breathe. I'm like, you know, I still see everything. I'm going to make the moves here. I'm tired, but I can see everything. But if you can control that, which comes with a lot of lots of experience, you know, it really does help learning how to breathe correctly.
No, I feel like that's probably one of the most misunderstood tools and misappreciated tools in the world, because even when I do a workout, sometimes if I breathe correctly, I can do that workout three times better than if I don't breathe correctly, if I'm not well rested, you know. So those things, they all, as Fabio, you painted the beautiful picture, they all mesh together very well. And I think for us chess players, and obviously for you guys as chess boxers as well, I'm sure it matters. It matters a lot. Now, yeah, go ahead, Matt.
I can add something to that. A little bit more just to kind of round that out. So over 50% of mistakes that happen in chess games and chess boxing matches happen in the first 15 seconds of the round. And that just shows exactly what Canty was talking about, which is it is a very difficult thing to do to start to wrangle your breath after a boxing round. Because it's difficult, less people do it. And if you're able to do it, you make less mistakes. So because it's difficult, it's why you should practice it, why you should get the repetitions, why it matters so much to not be in that, you know, bad side of the 50% at the beginning of a chess round following a boxing round. And that box breathing that Canty was talking about, the beginner way of doing it is a 4-second inhale, 4-second hold, 4-second exhale, 4-second hold with empty. Mm-hmm. And what's happening there is the reason it's called a box breathing is because of that hand motion I just did, where it forms an equal sided box, a square, where 4 second in each direction. But if you think about it, you're only inhaling for 4 of the 16 seconds. So you're essentially doing the same kind of central nervous system work of exiting sympathetic to go to parasympathetic with that 4 second hold, 4 second exhale, 4 second hold empty, because you're getting 12 seconds of the exhale where you aren't inhaling. And it's a really good start. What people have trouble with is also what Canty touched on, which is that empty breath hold. Naturally, we are almost never fully empty breath. And if you think about it, think about like a bicep curl, where you want to go from 180 degrees to 90 degrees up to as far as you can go. You know, you'll never get all the way to 0 degrees, but you want a full range of motion with a bicep curl. Think about your lungs like a muscle in the same way. If you're never going through the full range of motion of your lungs all the way down to empty, all the way up to full, then there's a natural atrophy that happens where your lung doesn't have to use all the way to full lungs or all the way to empty lungs. So if you keep stretching it out, if you keep compressing it down to the you know, the lowest it can go, you're exploring that spectrum of your lungs in a way that is uncommon, and it makes your lungs a lot stronger. And you build that self-awareness, that body awareness, that lung awareness to be able to use your lungs in whichever way that the scenario demands. And I love that Fabi's already practiced some yoga. Yoga is what informed my breath work going into chess boxing. I became a certified yoga teacher in 2019. I have 300 hours of training. And a lot of that was on the pranayama side of yoga, just the breath work side. Mm-hmm. And I think breath work can enhance every facet of your life. You know, it can psych you up for conversations or presentations. It can chill you out after, you know, emotional moments or fights. It can make things feel better from a sensory perspective. It can kind of make things kind of like a blur or numb out if you don't want to feel them as much. It's this tool that we're always walking around with that we hardly ever use that can turn you into a superhero if used effectively.
I love it. Matt, I need to ask you, now that we're kind of fading into the final moments of the episode, what's next for chess boxing? Where do you think this one is headed?
So two things. One is an announcement that I wanted to say for your podcast.
Okay.
That I think your audience is going to like.
Okay. Let's go.
Canty doesn't know this yet either. And the main one is we just had this incredible media exposure through 60 Minutes. It's the most successful show in history. It's been the show with the biggest numbers for the last 51 years. 12 million live people watched the segment, and both Canty and I's phone and other members of Team USA's phones are blowing up because this really blew the dog whistle for all the weird kind of people that hear this and are like, I'm born for this. That's the reaction I had. That's a similar reaction to what Canty had. And so a lot of people are reaching out. And so we're having a Team USA tryout tour in 2026, starting in Q1. That's going to go through the major U.S. markets. The ones that we have confirmed are New York, Chicago, Atlanta, Austin, and L.A. There may be others added to that list. But if you think you want to try this at any kind of level, it doesn't have to be a world championship level. It can be a non-contact level, just getting involved with getting your heart rate up and then playing chess as a baseline, or getting all the way up to where Canty is, which is competing at the highest level. If you fall anywhere in that spectrum and you want to try it out, reach out. It's at Moving with Matt or at United Chess Boxing. We also have a brand new website, UnitedChessBoxing.com, where you can fill out a form and we can get you plugged into where you need to be. So that's number one. In the United States specifically, but also worldwide, I have a board seat for the WCBO. So if you want to get involved and you are in the U.S., I can help you with that too. The announcement is really for you, Christian, and people like you.
Okay.
Which is, if head trauma is the main thing keeping you from chess boxing, and if you still want to do something like this with a lot less risk, we will be rolling out other chess combat hybrids in 2026. This will be an effort in partnership with other organizations like chess.com, and a massive sports organization that I can't announce yet, but we are doing chess combat hybrids for chess karate, chess taekwondo, chess judo, chess grappling, and chess jujitsu.
Chess jitsu, baby, yes.
So those are the five that we're
that's
starting
fire,
with.
Bro. That's actually amazing.
Sign me up for that.
Chess jitsu, wow.
And the benefit of all of these is that damage to your opponent does not count towards the decision for the match. And what that does is it helps us be able to sanction it in the United States with a lot less regulation parameters and insurance. And it also makes it a lot more accessible to a traditional chess audience where, you know, with karate and taekwondo, it's only point sparring. If you hit too hard, you actually get disqualified or get points deducted. And the others, it's all pushing art or grappling arts where there isn't even head trauma that can happen as a normal state of competition. Sometimes whiplash happens or whatever, but it's not how you work your way to winning. So we're super excited about this. We're actually rolling it out first to youth athletics through our partner. So we'll have kids growing up with chess combat hybrids as, if not their main focus, then something that they can compete in regularly, you know, quarterly or annually. And we're hoping that this sparks the growth of chess combat in the United States so we can compete with the powerhouses in the chess boxing world like Russia, who ended up winning this past world championship. So I wanted to announce it to a chess audience. I couldn't think of a better podcast or group of people to share it with first. But I've been working hard on it since the end of the world championship. We have our partners in place. We're developing the rule sets now. If you want to contribute to those rule sets, you too, let me know. And yeah, I'm really excited to share that with you guys.
You heard
That's
it
very, very first.
Yeah. Yeah.
Christian, I think this is your, chess jujitsu world championship awaits you.
That's 100% my thing.
We're about to be a world champ. We got two world champs in the call.
I was thinking of putting something like that together. I'm happy to hear that Matt is actually already actively putting that together. Fabi, I think you should get into jiu-jitsu as well. That's easy on the body, sort of. Not really, but
yeah, you know, the only thing that stopped me is when you got that, do you remember that infection? And then I was,
yes, yeah. Well, and I was, you do get skin infections from jiu-jitsu.
I was,
yes.
I was
from wrestling, from the mats.
I was scared away from
it. Happens,
honestly.
yeah.
But yeah, that's very exciting news.
Very exciting, Matt. Great news, and I'm sure we'll talk about this behind the scenes, maybe put something together. I'm definitely very excited about that. And yeah, maybe we can move it past the youth as well into adult and pro levels also. So yeah, that's very exciting. Matt, congratulations on everything you've been accomplishing around chess boxing. James, I mean, that's just an incredible feature that you managed to accomplish, becoming a world chess boxing champion. So yeah, congratulations, guys. And thank you for joining the podcast and sharing all of this interesting ideas with us and very cool news as well. So
thanks, boys. I appreciate it. I'm a world champ, dog. Hey, Fabi, I'm a world champ, bro.
Congratulations. Right. Congrats, guys.
That's right. That's right. That's right.
Thanks for joining.
Love guys, that passion. Yeah, thanks a lot, guys. Very grateful for you. And yeah, see you around.
Cheers, everybody. Bye-bye.